One of the interesting features of retirement is you live on a knife edge as to whether or not, at what point does your currency cease? At what point you're living off the past and not part of the present or the future? But luckily for me, we're actually at a time in Scottish education where the here and now and where we want to get to, we can't revisit often enough the aspiration that Scottish education has set for itself in terms not just of curriculum for excellence, and I want to talk more widely about that, but one of the things I have had the opportunity to do is to look at Scotland a little bit from abroad rather than from inside Scotland, that I've done a variety of things in different contexts, including working for the OECD. And there's no doubt about it that when you look at what it is that we are currently engaged in Scotland in terms of the broader reform agenda around curriculum for excellence, that is setting a benchmark internationally in terms of the way in which education might go. And interestingly, particularly working with the OECD, there's a lot of comment about what's happening in Scotland and the way in which Scotland is going, which they are looking at in the context of other countries. So that's reinforced for me just how important the agenda is that we've set for ourselves, and how daunting that agenda might be. But nonetheless, it's one that I'm absolutely convinced that we are both up for and able to achieve. And if we do that, we'll have made an enormous difference for youngsters in Scotland. And what I want to do is to put to you a number of propositions about where we are and where we might get to. The first one is very important. The reason that Scotland can do is setting itself, the agenda it's setting itself, is because we have a strong education system. It's because this is not a deficit model. This is not trying to fix problems that exist currently in Scottish education. It's about setting, it's about building on the strength that we currently have, recognising that strength, and using that as the basis for doing something pretty special. So I think when I hear, and I was listening to some of it on the radio this morning as it was coming across on the phone-in, there's a kind of assumption that there are things that are wrong in Scottish education. Now, there are things that need to be fixed in Scottish education, but that's not what we're about. We are actually about recognising and building on the considerable strength that we have and moving on from that. But the second proposition is, not despite, but because of that strength and because of a lot of other factors that are around it I'll speak to you about in a minute, we cannot rest on our laurels. We have to improve. It's not an option to rest on where we currently are. And the frequent cry of, can we please stop all this change and just let us concentrate on what we do? That's not an option. The world isn't like that. It probably never was like that, but it certainly isn't like that now. And the world that our young people are going to live in demands an education system which is in tune with that 21st century, not one which is in tune with maybe at best the 20th century, but certainly not the 21st century. So we're strong, we need to improve, and we can improve because we are strong. First two propositions. Curriculum for Excellence, again, looking across the board, I believe sets the right agenda, and we'll say a bit more about that in a minute. But we mustn't see Curriculum for Excellence as just simply another initiative. It's not the latest. It's not, you know, standard grade 5 to 14, higher still, now it's Curriculum for Excellence. It's just a series of one-off developments, big, important developments in their own right. Curriculum for Excellence is different from those that went before. We need to think about it not as another initiative, but as a change of thinking about the nature of Scottish education. And in that context, we need to rethink our approach to change. If we look back at those previous major developments, which have punctuated my career, they've all basically operated on a research, development, and dissemination model. They've all been, we identify an area that needs attention. We think very carefully about what it is that might be done to try and improve that, normally gathering together in different forms the great and the good to think through ways in which reform might be taken forward. We then produce that in a form which is designed to support implementation, and then there's a rollout programme. So it's a research, development and dissemination model. Curriculum for Excellence, again, is not like that. It's about a different way of thinking about how you bring about change. And the answer in all of that lies in the classroom. And again, one of the interesting things about the way in which we've sought to improve Scottish education over many decades has almost done everything but focus very directly on the classroom. It's focused on all the things that influence the classroom, but has not looked at the classroom itself, the nature of the teaching and learning process, the nature of the teacher's job, and the way in which the teacher goes about their job. The focus now is very much on the answer lies in the classroom. How do we actually engage the hearts and minds of every single teacher in Scotland in this agenda, so they're part of it, rather than feeling that it's done to them? And I'll come back to that. I think we have in Scotland a coherent reform agenda. It's about more than curriculum for excellence, but curriculum for excellence is at the heart of it. Part of the rethinking of the change process is that we have to think about what we mean by leadership in a professional organisation, what we mean by leadership in the context of the kind of things that we're trying to do, both the nature of schools as organisations which are staffed by professionals. Leadership takes on a particular hue in that context, but also in the context of what it is that we're trying to achieve. So leadership doesn't require followership, or shouldn't be seen of as a culture of followership, and I'll come back to that at the end. And if we get all that right, if those propositions are right, then for those of you who are as old as I am, you remember a programme, a television programme called Not So Much a Programme, More a Way of Life. Well, I think in this context, if we get it right, this is not so much a curriculum, it's more a way of life. It's the totality of the way in which we think about the culture of Scottish education, what we're trying to achieve, who we are as professionals, charged with the responsibility, the very onerous responsibility of educating successive generations of young people who are the future of Scotland. Picking up on the point about fundamental strength and rebutting some of the stuff that is said about Scottish education, which tends to run us down and tends to start from the proposition that we need to change because we're not very good. Well, actually, OECD looked at us in 2007 and said a lot of very positive things about Scottish education. They looked in depth at the system. Although they also had some important messages for us, their basic message was a lot of what's happening in Scotland is already of a very high standard. And these are the kind of things that characterise that strength. We actually do quite well in the international league tables. So the PISA stuff is not a cause for crisis. We need to do better, but it's not in itself something which should lead us to feeling, unlike some other countries, where there's been what's described often as a PISA shock. They get the PISA results and suddenly say, oh my goodness, we're not half as good as we thought we were. We need to reform what we do relatively. In Scottish terms, a lot of what it's telling us about our performance is quite encouraging. We do relatively well, but we need to do a lot better. Our approach to evaluation, the extent to which self-evaluation has now become pretty well an accepted feature of the way in which our schools operate across the country. Again, there's a lot of countries across the world will give their eye teeth to have an education system where schools were thinking about self-evaluation and putting that into practice in the way that has increasingly become the case over Scottish schools over the course of the last 10, 15, 20 years. Curriculum for Excellence, as I say, is admired across the world as being the right agenda. And critically important, vitally important for me to say and for us to recognise that we have a teaching profession in Scotland which again, in international terms, is an extremely, it's well respected internally, it's a high performing education, teaching profession, and we recruit into that profession some very, very able people, many very, very able people. So we don't start again from saying, oh my goodness, the teachers are the problem. The teachers are definitely not the problem, they are the solution, and we need to think about whether we are harnessing the potential that's in our teaching force as well as we might do. The leadership culture, again, across my career, our approach to leadership and the quality of leadership in Scottish schools has improved dramatically. Those who say, you know, there was once a golden age where the Healy was all-powerful. The Director of Education and the Healy were both all-powerful in terms of Scottish education. That meant that everything was fine. Certainly wasn't the case then, and isn't the case now. What we have, though, is an approach, a thought, a thinking about leadership, about the way in which we approach leadership, which has become increasingly sophisticated in the context of the very, very difficult job of leadership in the professional context of a school. We've had a general teaching council since 1965, right at the forefront in terms of thinking about professional standards and a profession that's taking responsibility for its own regulation. Post-Macron, the approach that we've had to induction, the contractual element of continuing professional development, again, is something which is best practice in a world context, and we were there early in the process. With GLOW, we were making very good progress in terms of ICT infrastructure, certainly in terms of the nature of use of ICT for teaching purposes in classrooms. We're well ahead of the game. We need to make sure we don't fall back in relation to that. As everybody in this room will know, the problem with ICT is that it changes by the second, and therefore it's very hard to keep pace with it. But in terms of ICT, we are again a lot better placed than many countries across the world. So if we look at all of that, it all sounds pretty good. But then the OECD also said this about us. And that's a pretty hard-hitting statement about Scottish education. That's saying something to us, which is basically a warning shot across our bows, saying lots of good things, but don't rest on your laurels. And if you don't think radically about the nature of your education system, then you're unlikely to maintain your current quality. It's likely to reduce. So an important shot across the bows, I say, from the OECD. And then if we think about the kind of things which are issues that we, again, across my career, have been trying to address with varying degrees of success, the big one is this impact of destiny on our young people. Too many of our young people are destined not to succeed at school almost from the point of conception. The nature of what happens in Scotland is creating a context within which many young people, what we're doing in the education system is almost engaging in damage limitation almost right from the start. But on the other hand, when you look comparatively at how well our school system does in comparison with other school systems in terms of defeating that destiny, taking young people from backgrounds which make it more difficult for them to succeed at school, we do less well than other countries to do. The famous statement in the OECD report in 2007, who you are matters too much in Scotland. And that's not to do with which school you go to. It's not that there are schools in deprived areas and that's the problem. It's your family background, irrespective of the school you go to, matters more in Scotland than it does in many other countries in the world. And we need to think about that as professionals engaged in education. What is it that we could do that would help in that process of defeating destiny, as well as the things that have to be done in terms of the early experience of young people, both pre-3 and certainly in the early stages of nursery and primary education. We need to keep on raising standards. The extent to which too many of our young people are turned off, particularly for maths, from maths at a very early age, and feel either they can't or they don't want to engage with maths. Interestingly, I saw a piece of research, I'm not sure how respectable it is, but a piece of research which indicated that, you know, if you're a parent and you want to advise your child how to be more successful in life, the advice you should give them is stick with maths as long as you can, because there's a big correlation between those who succeed in maths and those who succeed in the world of work. Maths is a good ticket to future success. But it's a lot more than that. But we do need to think about that, and it has been a problem for us. It's respectable not to say you can't do mass. It's respectable to be enumerate in a Scottish context. It should not be respectable to be so. And the same thing applies with modern languages. It's not just that we suffer from the fact that we speak English and that therefore there's a big disincentive to learn any other language, because wherever you go, you can always get by with English, and that's a problem. And in other countries also, English is the passport to a lot of the youth culture, so that young people learn English because it suits them in their wider lives, not just because... But actually, if you go to Holland or you go to Sweden, they've got third languages and fourth languages, which are much better than anything we do in terms of a second language. So it's not just we compare their learning of English. You compare their learning of German or their learning of Spanish. They're better at that than we are. Why is it that we cannot engage our young people in language learning? Why is it that we seem to be unable to keep young people engaged and wanting to learn a modern foreign language throughout their school careers? And there's obviously stuff being done on that just now. But the same is true of science, same is true of basic skills. But there's a cluster of things around there which are to do with the standards of the population as a whole, which we need to address and which Curriculum for Excellence is intended to address. We have got this consistent and continuing tension between being very clear what it is we want to achieve. So that tends to lead to you specifying curriculum and outcomes in great detail, and that squeezing out the kind of things that actually make learning enjoyable and make youngsters want to engage in learning as lifelong learners. So you, the more you specify, the more you make it almost managerial in terms of thinking about the curriculum, which sounds like the right thing to do, but actually has this problem of squeezing out the context, the capacity to engage in some of the other things which are very important. And again, where does the balance lie? And we've kind of dotted back and forward over the course of the last 20 or 30 years in Scotland in terms of the degree of specificity. We've never gone... It's never been that we've had a curriculum in Scotland like in England, for example, with the national curriculum and the testing, but we've never had that. There's a lot of mythology around the nature of the Scottish curriculum. But nonetheless, there's an issue for us in terms of what's the right balance to strike between specificity and creating the space for engaging teaching and learning. And what I think lies at the heart of Curriculum for Excellence is we kid ourselves in Scotland about giving our youngsters a broad general education. For most young people, their progress through school to the point at which they leave, and if you talk to them about the nature of what it is they want to get from school, it'll be almost entirely defined in terms of qualifications. So what we have is an education system that is geared towards getting qualifications, but hasn't been well geared towards ensuring that we have a generation of people who are well educated in the round and have the skills, capacities, dispositions which are part of being an educated Scot. We've tended increasingly as the youngsters move through to focus in on qualifications. And qualifications matter, for goodness sake, you know. In my previous role, it was something which I was very strong on. They do matter. They are the things that help to dictate the life chances of young people. We do no favours for our young people by not giving them the best shot we possibly can at the tickets which society sees as important. And the tickets which society sees as important are the qualifications. So that's an obligation on us. But that's not an alternative to a broad general education. That's something that builds from a broad general education, which is one of the key messages of Curriculum for Excellence. So, part of the reason, the things that we need to do in terms of improvement are about addressing some of these issues that have been around for a while. But actually, education systems across the world have to improve because of the nature of the world that we live in. Education has moved centre stage in terms of government policy in almost every country along the, across the world. Education is now one of the key, if not, well, certainly one of the key areas of policy. It's where ambitious ministers make their name is in with the education brief, and that certainly wasn't the case in the past. And why have they done that? Why has it become centre stage? And it's because education is perceived, rightly or wrongly, to be critical to this business of human capital, this business of ensuring that in a 21st century world, the interconnected world that we have, that the success which individuals will have and which societies will have will depend critically on the extent to which we have a population which is well educated in the fullest sense of the word, and that increasingly is the driver. That's why there's this constant debate, including the debate that was on the radio this morning, about what do we do in order to improve the quality of education in our schools. This constant process of the search for improvement in education. And one of the messages that I hope I leave you with today is, if we don't, people in this room and our colleagues across Scotland who are involved in education, if we don't address that issue, it'll be done for us. We don't address it, then the agenda will be forced on education. That's true in every country in the world, that either the profession rises to the challenge of continuous improvement, or there'll be solutions that will be arrived at, which many of us will not like in terms of the way in which that improvement will be brought about. Solutions may not work, but they will be seen as ways of bringing about change. And we have seen some of that in Scotland already, and we'll no doubt see a bit more. And of course, we all live in the context of a world which is changing almost exponentially. The nature of change, largely driven by information and communication technology, but not wholly so, but also by globalisation more generally, means that the nature of the world that our young people are going to hopefully thrive in is a world which itself is going to be characterised by constant change. That's the reality of the process, and that's got profound implications for how we think about education. Profound implications for what does teaching and learning mean in a world where particularly the impact of ICT is changing the rules about access to learning. It's changing the rules about the pace of learning. If it was ever the case that teachers could control access and pace of learning through the process that youngsters go through through schools, if that's not already gone, it's fast going. It's perfectly possible for young people to access lots of other sources of learning than the teacher in the classroom. So the question for education is, what does that mean for education in the 21st century, and particularly as the 21st century progresses? So all of that led again to some of these quotes from the OECD. These are not about Scotland, these are just generally. Basically saying we still operate largely on a quasi-industrial model of education, that we take youngsters through the education system in a fairly lockstep way, that we group them together in classes and they move forward. Now, some of that will no doubt still be the case, but we mustn't say that's an eternal truth, that the way we do things now, the way we have done things in the past, is an eternal truth. And the best people to think about how might things be different are the teachers, not people coming from outside telling us how to do it. It's very important that we embrace and think about the implications of some of the things that the OECD have said. I'm not going to go through that, but some of the characteristics of what we're talking about for these young people, what it will be to be a successful learner in the 21st century. Now, to some extent, all of those were true in the 20th century as well, but they're true in spades in the 21st century, the kind of things that we need in terms of attitudes toward learning and the ability to thrive and grow throughout your life, no matter what career or area of work that you're engaged in. Will be of critical importance, and what we do during that period when young people are at school is absolutely vital in terms of creating the capacity for learning along the lines that is up on the screen there. We have, over the course of the last 50 years at least, again across the world, there's been this search for the, if not the magic bullet, there's been this search for how is it that you reform and improve education systems? What is it that you do in order to make this incredibly and frustratingly stubborn beast that is very resistant to change, very conservative, and to some extent rightly conservative, because when people talk about there's not enough risk in education, I worry a bit about that, because of course it's not teachers that take risks, it's children that take risks at the end of the day. So we have to be very responsible in terms of the way we manage risk and think about risk in the context of education, but that shouldn't lead to a sclerotic approach to change inside education. And there's been this a process over the course of 50 years and longer where assumption, the big problem was how do you actually get kids into classrooms? How do they stay in school longer? So an expansion of provision was seen as being particularly important. 57 Sputnik created a problem, a crisis in the West, because the assumption was we were losing the space race to the Russians, and the problem must lie in the education system. We're not producing enough scientists, we're not producing enough people who are capable of ensuring that we have the technological advance that's required for us to be able to compete with the Russians in terms of, and remember, that's the height of the Cold War. That's when this was really serious stuff. And that led to a whole range of alphabet soup, so-called curriculum reform. Lots and lots of curriculum reform projects with initials of one kind or another. Enormous expansion of that in the 60s and early 70s. Then we had the standards movement and the measurement mania, as I've called it there, but the assumption that actually, the first bit was about doing lots of stuff, putting stuff into schools and trying to encourage people to do things. Second thing is to say, actually, what we need to do is to say, what are the outcomes, what are the standards that are being achieved, and how can we get a handle on that, and processes to try and get finer and finer gradation of those standards. Then the school effectiveness movement, trying to say, why are some schools better than others? Why are some schools more successful than others? What are the characteristics of an effective school? And again, a whole lot of literature generated around the whole business of school effectiveness. A period in the mid-80s and 90s, particularly in England, where the profession was seen as part of the problem, not as part of the solution, that those engaged, not just in teaching, but professions generally, but if we take teaching, conspired together to keep the parents out and to keep, to create a fairly cosy life for themselves, where schools were more for teachers than they were for children. Hence, the move towards marketisation, the move towards competition, the move towards publication of evidence about how schools are performing, move towards increased inspection designed to inform parents better about where the good schools were and the less good schools, so the children could move. That whole process of marketisation, all part of the same search for success. How do we move this stubborn beast that politicians believe needs to be better than it currently is? More recently, we've come back in the last 4 or 5 years, maybe slightly longer, to say, all of that is the surround. At the end of the day, things will only get better. We will only improve the quality of what happens in relation to learning and teaching. If the teachers are on board, if we win the hearts and minds of teachers and the capacities of teachers to be able to do that. And again, the Teachers Matter is the title of a report that was produced in 2005, which very much emphasised the importance of the teacher. And that's dictated quite a lot of what's happened in the last few years, again, in different countries across the world. There's still a kind of more is better thing that just is just below the surface, that actually if you just have more teachers, that would improve things. Now, there may be some truth in that, but if I was given a choice between more teachers and better teachers, I'd go for better teachers every time. A good teacher with a large class and a bad teacher with a small class, you're actually going to do better with a good teacher in the large class. So we need to think about, more doesn't automatically mean better, and we need to think in that context about teacher unions need to think about what it is that they're asking for at the end of the day. The tendency is to just want to say the answer lies in more teachers. I think for the profession, and it's in everybody's interest that the profession is as strong as possible, quality should be the critical agenda that's being pursued both by all sides in relation to education. So from all of that, I think we need a new synthesis. We need a new way of thinking about how is it that we actually go about the business of having higher quality learning and teaching, having more engaging learning and teaching, and having young people who have enjoyed that process in a way that makes them want to continue learning throughout their lives, rather than saying, you know, thank God I've got my higher, or thank God I've got my National 4, whatever it might be, that's me finished. So that learning, the way in which we've gone about the process means that people are not turned off by it, but turned on to the process of learning. So the challenge, as I see it, we need higher levels of education. Innovation is central to educational qualities. Just resting on our laurels, doing what we've done in the past, cloning the past is not the way, the way in which we are going to proceed. We need to create the future, not recreate the past. And that means we've got to think about ways in which we go about the whole process of education, which are much more dynamic. And that means, I think, rethinking the relationship between teaching, leadership, curriculum, and accountability. And that's the agenda that is currently underway in Scotland. That's the coherent reform agenda, which I think this conference is about. That the Curriculum for Excellence, Teaching Scotland's Future, and Advancing Professionalism in Teaching, the McCormick Report, those three are all part of one agenda. And they're all part of the agenda that I've just talked about in terms of how do we get the hearts and minds of teachers, and how do we ensure that we've got the kind of approach to the way we think about education, which is going to lead to an approach to change and improving quality, which is built in rather than bolt on in terms of the cliche. So it is, I think, an ambitious reform programme we're talking about. I'm not going to go into with you, you know this well enough, about the nature of Curriculum for Excellence. But if there's one thing that matters more than anything else, I'm not terribly worried about what will happen with National 4 and 5 and what will happen with the hires. That will sort itself out. The pressures there in terms of making sure that works are so powerful that, I mean, it may be difficult, but it'll sort itself out, and that will happen, and that will happen in a way that is going to allow the progression of young people into future careers with qualifications which they require. So that may seem like the hard bit just now. It's not. The hard bit of Curriculum for Excellence is this broad general education. The hard bit of Curriculum for Excellence is to be very clear what we mean by a broad general education and what we mean by ensuring that we have a generation of educated Scots in the full sense of that word, educated Scot, not just qualified Scot. So that's the hard bit of Curriculum for Excellence, and we're still struggling with that. And you can see that around the debates around 2+2+2 in secondaries and 3+3, whatever it might be, all the various permutations. But the prize, it seems to me, of, for the first time, having young people who are coming through an education system where from the time they enter nursery at 3 through to the end of S3, that period, 3 to 15, as a profession, we're working together collectively to ensure that our young people are getting as sound a basis of education and as good a love of learning as we can give them, as a springboard for what happens next, as a springboard for qualifications or whatever it is that they're going to do thereafter, is the critical bit, I think, about Curriculum for Excellence. And I'm happy to go into that with you afterwards. It's about deeper learning. It's about higher standards. Again, if you go into classrooms up and down the country and you say to teachers, what's Curriculum for Excellence about? You will very rarely get the answer to raise standards. You'll tend to get answers that are to do with process. You know, Curriculum for Excellence is about interdisciplinary learning, or Curriculum for Excellence is about cooperative learning, or it's about whatever. It tends to be about process that people define it as, instead of defining Curriculum for Excellence actually in terms of raising standards. And what all raising standards means is that our young people will have better and more solid learning than they have had in the past. That's what Curriculum for Excellence, that's the test, it seems to me, of Curriculum for Excellence. And within that, literacy and numeracy are important. But in an advanced country like Scotland, we should almost take literacy and numeracy for granted. The fact that we have to focus on that so much is to our shame as professionals. It is very hard to understand why any more than a very small number of young people with very particular circumstances should leave our schools not functionally literate, or higher than that, and functionally numerate. And yet we know that about 20% plus of the adult population have difficulties in both literacy and numeracy. We need to fix that, and that's partly what Curriculum for Excellence is about. And that's about how we go about the job, and that's the bit about the pedagogy. And it's also about assessment. I still worry about assessment in the context of Curriculum for Excellence. What we must be very, very careful about is that what we assess is what we profess. That the kind of learning that we're talking about in Curriculum for Excellence is what's assessed at the end of the day. And we don't, and that's difficult, because the kind of things we're talking about are actually quite difficult to assess. So the assessment in Curriculum for Excellence is not, you know, just getting better at what we've always done. We've actually got to think quite carefully about the nature of what the learning is and how we go about assessing that in a way that's going to really reinforce that learning and not give the message that that was the learning, but here's what matters, and it's what we test at the end of at the end of the day. There's all of that. There's the new paradigm of government and change. We'll come back to that, and a revitalised teaching profession. And that, my argument is one aligned agenda. And if we don't have it as one aligned agenda, then in a few years' time, we will have. Something that will be called Curriculum for Excellence. It will. Some of the labels will have changed. We will have new qualifications in S4, but the reality, the potential that lies in this reform programme will not have been realised if we don't see it as one aligned agenda and pick it off and try and do little bits of it. Then we will have done a disservice to the potential which Curriculum for Excellence can make for Scottish children. And if we look at the kind of things which we know. Characterise high performance across the world. If you just look down that list, that's the form programme we're talking about. Those are the kind of things that we're trying to do in Scotland. We've learned the lessons. We're engaged in each one of those in a different way in order to try and learn from what works and to make that operate in a Scottish context. So the agenda we're talking about, the curriculum agenda, the teacher agenda, the broader governance agenda, these are all part of one process, and they're learning from what we know, or think we know, about how to produce high quality education in different parts of the world. How much do teachers matter? When I was doing the review of teacher education, this was an interesting question for me. How much do teachers matter? You can have a view of teachers, and actually it's a view that some teachers would hold, but you certainly can have a view which many people in the broader public hold, that teaching is actually a relatively straightforward job. Essentially, if you know what it is that you're supposed to be teaching, and you have got a repertoire of techniques that you use in the classroom, you put those two together, bingo, you get high quality teaching. And that's a kind of craft view of teaching, and to some extent in some countries not a million miles away from here, that's a view that is quite strong in terms of the nature of education, the way in which education reform is going. McKinsey's got this famous quote, which is probably a bit of hyperbole, but it still hits you between the eyes, and it's a kind of obvious truth. The quality of an education system cannot exceed the quality of its teachers. And if that's true, what do we then focus on in trying to raise the quality of education? We focus on the quality of our teachers. And we need teachers for the 21st century who have high levels of expertise, and that's high levels of expertise in the what, the how, and the why of teaching. High level expertise on what it is that they're teaching, the actual subject matter, they have confidence in what they're teaching. They have confidence in the way in which you go about that, the process of learning, of facilitating and supporting learning, and that relationship between teaching and learning. And they understand why certain things are working and why you need to keep reviewing it and thinking about it, and are open to the evidence that comes from out with the classroom and comes out with intuition or out with experience, but actually are open to evidence about ways in which better learning and teaching can be arrived at by learning from others out with yourself. The bit about secure values, it seems to me, is incredibly important. We probably haven't spent focus enough on this. I know GTCS are looking closely at this in the revision of standards, and I'm very pleased about that. Because if the 21st century is going to be characterised by dramatic change, that change is liable to be also characterised by people who will have all sorts of solutions. There'll be fashions. There always have been fashions in education, but there'll be fashions. And the thing that helps you to not be buffeted by that process is your own value system, understanding why you are a teacher, what are your responsibilities as a teacher, as an individual, to the young people you have in your charge. So we need to be a bit clearer, I think, in education about our values and more straightforward in terms of how we express those values. I think to be a teacher should mean that you take responsibility for being able to do your job. So in terms of learning and your growth throughout your career, you don't wait to be sent on a course by somebody who says you should go on a course. The responsibility for being able to do your job and continue to do your job well in a changing context lies with you as the individual teacher. We haven't really had that culture in a lot of teachers do it, but it's not really the culture. And even when you talk about in-service training, you talk about training people as if they were dogs to do, you know, particular tricks. We give them a dose of this or a dose of that. We need teachers who are much, much more reflective and about themselves and the way in which they will grow and how they relate to the job that they're doing. That's the 21st century teacher. And that teacher's not on their own. We also need a culture which is much more, and actually Scotland's moved quite well on this over the course of the last decade or so, where, you know, teacher's not isolated in his or her classroom, but is part of a team that is learning from each other. And there's lots of interesting stuff happening in terms of learning rounds and different ways of helping people to learn from each other. No shame to learn from somebody else who's doing the job, and they can learn from you. And so teaching should be a much less isolated job than it has traditionally been. I entered teaching a long time ago. It was a very isolated job. You know, you're starting in Pollock back in 1970. First day in school, no, nothing. I'm shown the cupboard. I'm told that's the books for the first year. Bless your timetable. Get on with it. That was. And you were on your own. You could sink or swim in the context of that, and it was up to you. Now we've moved a long way. We need to move a long way further and see teaching very much as a collective, collegiate endeavour where we are a team working together and learning from each other and growing as a team. And there's lots of good stuff happening in Scotland just now round about that and that process. If we get that right, then professional learning becomes the change process. It's not something that's done to us in sort of major seismic shifts. But professional learning, that process, dynamic process of growth and change, is taking place through a process of learning, not through a process of lockstep major reform programmes. It may still be necessary, but the bulk of what happens should be happening more generally. And that means that we need a teaching profession which sees itself as being part of change, part of research. So research doesn't become something which is esoteric, out there somewhere, and it's nor is it invested with all sorts of mystique. But research is about reflecting and thinking about learning, being open to evidence from elsewhere, and then applying that in the context of your own classroom or school. So you'll be delighted to know I'm not going to go through the 50 recommendations in my report, but essentially, the things on the screen are as the essence of what the report was about. We need to be sure, we need to be very picky about who becomes a teacher in Scotland. You think of the list of qualities that I talked about there, you think of the importance of the job, put those two together, and we need to be very sure that the people who are coming into the profession are people of the highest quality, and there's work underway to do that. Initial teacher education, as it currently stands, has served us well in the past. The BEd degree, for example, introduced in 79 first graduates in 83, replacing the diploma in primary, has worked well. I mean, there's no question about it. But when we're thinking about the 21st century teacher, we need to look again at the nature of what's happening in initial teacher education. There's lots of developments that are currently taking place there in terms of both the degrees, which will be, I think, across all universities, will be revamped by 2014, both the undergraduate and the postgraduate provision, but also in terms of the relationship, the partnership between schools and universities in terms of the way in which we go about recreating the profession. And that's not the university's job on its own. It's about working collaboratively with the university and with the schools that we should see, all of us should see, being part of this profession brings with it a responsibility to help to recreate the profession and regenerate the profession. We're all part of that process of regeneration of the teaching profession. It's not somebody else's job to do that. So the universities, I think, need to be bigger players in this process, but they need to be players in a way that's much more plugged into the reality of the nature of what's happening in our schools. GCSEs standards, I think, are a very helpful point of reference. We've had them for quite a long time. They are undergoing a process of review and revision just now. I think that's important. I recommended in the report something called a standard for active registration. I don't think GCSEs like the title, but they're going to do something, I think, along those lines, which they say for the more experienced teacher, can we give them a point of reference which is about professional growth? A point of reference which is about, you know, what are the kind of things which I ought to be thinking about in terms of my own professional growth? And we ought to plug our PRD process into that so that PRD doesn't become, as it all too often is just now, either a fairly ritualistic or a process which people go through but don't actually believe in very much. And that certainly came through in the review very strongly. It wasn't something which figured largely, but actually have a process where the professional review and development process and the self-reflection part of that and the nature of a reference point in terms of standards which are not for full registration, not for what it is to enter the profession, but what it is to grow in the profession as part of the way in which we think about change and development for individual teachers. A culture of coaching and mentoring, and again, there's more of that, much more of that in our schools than there was in the past. We need to build on that. We're still at the foothills of using ICT. Some encouraging stuff happening, some important stuff happening, but we need to get better at using ICT, if for no other reason than it's often a more efficient way of engaging in the process. I mean, the major currency in teaching is time. That's the unit of currency that matters more than anything else. So we need to find ways of using that time to best effect, and the more that we can get the right blend between face-to-face and remote approaches, the better. Master's level study, the norm. Too much of what passes for in-service training is quite frankly insulting to our teachers and can be done in a whole lot of different ways, much, much better. We ought to be using that precious time that is there to help our teachers to engage in things which are intellectually demanding and relevant to the classroom. Now, it doesn't mean to say every teacher has to have a master's, but it does. But eventually that we'll move in that direction. So again, some quite encouraging things happening in that direction. But it does mean that we should be thinking about, that's the sort of level at which we ought to be operating in terms of thinking about education, thinking about the nature of education and the challenges which will face us in the 21st century in terms of high quality learning and teaching. So we need to move significantly, I think, in that direction. Across Europe, master's level will increasingly be the norm. And in Scotland, we could move from having one of the best educated to one of the worst educated teaching forces in Europe. And that can happen very quickly. It's a big investment across Europe in terms of moving towards much teaching as a master's level profession. We need to think about that. And the last one, you probably would expect me to say, but the whole... The danger in all of that is that we get beguiled by process. That we do all those things and we forget actually the only thing that only works if it makes a difference for children at the end of the day. So the constant process of thinking about how is what we're doing making a difference for children in terms of impact on their learning, building that into the process. As I say, a lot of the stuff that we've done in Scotland in relation to self-evaluation has already taken us in that direction, and in a direction that is not about impact in terms purely of numbers, attainment numbers, but thinking about learning in the context of the broader issues that are around in Curriculum for Excellence. I want to say a couple of words about leadership, because I think that's a critical part of the agenda. If the McKinsey thing's true, and quality can't exceed the quality of its teachers, then it seems to me the prime job of leadership is to maximise that quality. The prime job of anyone who's in a leadership position, formal leadership position in Scottish education, is to ensure that they are building the capacity of their teachers and that those teachers are performing as well as they possibly can for their children. That seems to me to be the key job that anyone who's engaged in a leadership process has to do. But leadership in schools is complex and difficult. It doesn't lend itself to the W.H. Smith pull it off the shelf, 50 ways to be a good manager or a good leader. It doesn't lend itself to that kind of formulaic approach, if anything does, I don't know. But I mean, I know that schools definitely don't lend themselves to that. They're different kinds of beasts. But apart from anything else, we're talking about professionals. And so they're not, it's not, you know, units in an assembly line. We're talking about people who have a high degree of professional autonomy and should have a high degree of professional. But how do you, what does leadership mean in that context? And what we don't want is to see leadership would be improved if everybody just followed. You know, if everyone just did what they were told, sometimes that's attractive. But if everybody just did what they were told, everything would be fine. Well, actually, that's not the culture that we need. So we need a culture of leadership, which is not a culture of followership. And some of the recommendations in the report address that very directly. But, you know, thinking about leadership, the relentless focus on capacity building, building the capacity of each individual teacher, making sure that the people who we have working with our children are the right people, having the professional standards within which the process of leadership is helping to get this process of alignment so that we don't have different bits pushing and pulling in different directions. We need to have the rich arguments about what we should be doing, but we then need to get on and do it in a way that we're agreed about with the road forward, not pulling in all sorts of different directions. If we succeed in terms of the teacher agenda I was talking about, this kind of extended professionalism, then we tap into that most valuable of all bits, commodities in schools. That's discretionary effort. It's that thing that a teacher will give you if they choose to. But if they don't choose to, they won't. So they can do their job perfectly well, keep their nose clean, and you can't touch them for it. They're doing the job perfectly well. But there's that extra bit. There's that discretionary effort. There's the bit more that can be given. And that's the trick of leadership, is to tap into and release that discretionary effort. Make people do more than the minimum. Make people do more than just the day-to-day job. That seems to me to be a critical bit of leadership, but it's also a critical bit of how the profession should think about itself, and therefore we need to attack that from both ends. I talked about the collegiate culture. I talked about professional learning as being the dynamic of innovation that ought to be happening. We need to do more talent spotting and coaching inside schools. We need to try to ensure that we're bringing people on. That's not an elitist culture. It's a question of trying to ensure that all the different qualities that people have got are capitalised on and used, so the first-year teacher and the 20th-year teacher can all take on leadership roles inside a school if we build the right capacity. And in particular, we need to be sure that our experienced teachers don't see themselves as part of the problem rather than part of the solution. There's that kind of just below the surface message that, if only these older teachers get out of the way and let all the youngsters come through, everything would be fine. Well, A, that's not true, and B, they're not going to get out of the way anyway. And actually, the wealth of experience that rests with those experienced teachers is incredibly important. So if we don't win them, if they're not part of it, they often set the tone. Irrespective of what head does, they often set the tone inside a school, certainly inside a staff room. And therefore, engaging those experienced teachers in the process, particularly trying to engage them, experienced teachers, in the mentoring process, which I think is very important. You know, the aphorism, best way to learn is to teach. well, actually, if you're engaged in the mentoring process and you're thinking about how you're going to bring other people on, that has an impact on yourself, and you become part of this process of thinking about how do we make things better in this school. Is this all pie in the sky? Is this the famous, Scotland's the only country that can have two positive to make a negative. I write. Is that what people are saying, you know, in classrooms throughout the country? Some are. There's no question about that. So I think part of it is about what I'm talking about is a marathon, not a sprint. It's that process that is, we're putting in place processes that are going to continue to work over time. We don't have to say, you know, by X, it'll all be done and dusted. So it is something we need to think of as a marathon, not a sprint, as something which is going to develop and grow over time if we're going to realise the full potential. I've talked about this business of discretionary effort and belief. That will be critical. If the teachers don't believe in it, if we haven't got the hearts as well as the minds in relation to this, then we don't tap into that discretionary effort, and we will not get the momentum which is so necessary for this process to work. We must remember that a lot of what's currently happening is good, so we're building on strength. This isn't year zero. Mike Russell's not Pol Pot. The process is one which is growing and developing. And we've got a lot of strength to build on. A lot of what we're doing is only possible because of that strength. I talked about the collective effort that we need to get. The business about winning the hearts is about keeping on reminding people about the prize. You know, what is it we're trying to do in this school? What is it that we're trying to achieve? Why are these irksome things that, you know, are getting in your way? Where do they fit in terms of the bigger picture and the prize that we're trying to achieve at the end of the day? That builds in a process of continuous improvement, and critically, we need to get the alignment right. And people need to understand and see the alignment, because the debates tend to take place in pockets. They tend to take place around bits of the picture, and there isn't sufficient attention on how all of this joins up. So, from my point of view, what I hope I've said to you in terms of some of the big messages to do with Curriculum for Excellence Plus. We need to build in the past but not be imprisoned by it. I think that's vital. We need to get the coherence and alignment right. And that is about some structural stuff, but it's about just keeping on ensuring that we're all signed up to the same broad general direction. Doesn't mean we all do the same thing. It's all uniform, but far from it. But we need to be agreed about the direction that we're going in. We need to have a consistent and constant focus in building the capacity of our teachers. We need to have a profession that is not afraid of complexity, because this isn't simple stuff. The kind of issues that we're facing are not easy issues. They are complex. We mustn't have a profession afraid of complexity that's constantly asking, just tell me what to do. You know, just give me something simple to do and I can do it. Well, if that's what you want, actually, you're not a 21st century teacher, I have to say. You know, you're somebody whose time maybe has come and gone. We need that culture of aspiration, of reflection, and above all else, of optimism. People in this room, key people in terms of leading this agenda, have got to be optimistic. You've got to feel, yeah, this is worth doing and it can be done. Worth doing and can be done is something that we've got to constantly revisit ourselves in order to ensure that we don't lose heart in the process. I've talked about the nature of the profession. I won't go into that again. The key thing about that list of things that I talked about in terms of the teaching profession, that's not Graham Donaldson's wish list. That's government policy. That's happening just now. The National Partnership Group will report in a month's time or so. And its job is to make it happen. It's not to say, is this a good idea or not a good idea? Those list of things about the 21st century teaching profession, about the selection, about the career-long learning, the reform of ITE, the reform of the standards, the use of the reform of CPD, master's level, all of that is government policy. It's not, you know, something I'm just, you know, dreamed up in my bath. Maybe I did dream up in my bath, but it's now government policy. So there is a process that is underway, which hopefully will actually make a difference at the end of the day. I'm not naive enough to assume that government policy leads to practice at the end of the day. That's our job. is to try to see, you know, what, how that, if it's worthwhile, is translated into practice. The business of professional engagement and educational change, so we don't wait for it to be done to us as a profession, but we're part of shaping the future. Thinking about leadership differently, there's a whole big discussion about leadership which we could have, but that's probably for another time. And the accountability mechanisms are very important too. We must have approaches to accountability which reinforce all of this and don't pull in a different direction. That's part of the alignment, is that a bit like I said, assess what we profess. Well, we must assure that the accountability holds people to account for what matters, not for what doesn't matter. So it has big implications for the nature of the way in which accountability. We need accountability. The public needs to know that we are serving them well and doing well by their children. So accountability is a good thing. Profession should welcome accountability, but it needs to be intelligent accountability, which goes with the grain of what it is that we're trying to achieve. And if we do that, I think we end up with a different kind of approach to education in Scotland, and Curriculum for Excellence will be not so much a curriculum, more a way of life. Thank you very much.